This is the Alkazine Brief on UK Health Radio, your real feel-good radio with Peter Hofland.
In the past 30 years, the survival rates for breast cancer has improved by about 40%, one of the highest survival rates of any cancer. The increase in survival is, in part, due to advances in screening technology, as well as improvement to cancer treatment and a better understanding of the biology of cancer, all of which have had an impact on survival. Interestingly, research and best practices leading to an increase in survival has become much more personalized and targeted. And depending on the number of individual factors, two women with the same type of cancer may, as a result, not receive the same treatment. In this episode of the Oncogene Brief, I'm talking with Dr. Stephen Malamud. Dr. Malamud is the Regional Director of Medical Oncology at Nuvance Health, a health network with hospitals, medical practices, and care centers located throughout New York's Hudson Valley and Western Connecticut. Dr. Malamud is a board-certified and fellowship-trained physician who specializes in medical oncology for breast cancer. As an active clinical researcher, Dr. Malamud has been involved in clinical trials that resulted in the approval of many new cancer treatments. In this episode of the Oncogene Brief, we talk about some of the results of studies presented during the 2021 San Antonio Breast Cancer Symposium, held December 7 to 10, 2021 in San Antonio, Texas, and virtually via streaming media. For our program today, our editors have selected just a few key presentations. In each case, we briefly discuss the study, as well as how the results may improve the health-related quality of life of patients, and if the study results may change the way medicine is being practiced. I'm Peter Hofland, and this is the Oncogene Brief. The Oncogene Brief is developed in collaboration with our online journal, Oncogene, at oncogene.com, that is oncogine.com, where you can find additional information and the latest news about cancer, cancer diagnosis and treatment, and cancer prevention. For more information on how to support this program, visit our website at oncogene.com. And if you're living in the United States and want to receive our newsletter, text the word cancer, C-A-N-C-E-R, to 66866, and we will make sure that you'll receive our newsletter, which includes an overview of the latest news in oncology and hematology.
This is the Oncogene Brief. For the latest news about cancer and cancer treatment, visit our online journal, Oncogene, at www.oncogene.com.
On the phone is Dr. Stephen Malamud. Dr. Malamud is the Regional Director of Medical Oncology at Nuvance Health, a health network with hospitals, medical practices, and care centers located throughout New York's Hudson Valley and Western Connecticut. Dr. Malamud, welcome to the Oncogene Brief.
Good afternoon. Glad to be here.
Before we're going to talk about some of the results of studies presented at this year's San Antonio Breast Cancer Symposium, which just ended, tell me a little bit about yourself. How did you become an oncologist specializing in breast cancer?
Well, I'm a graduate of the Albert Einstein College of Medicine in the Bronx in New York, and left there to do oncology training at Mount Sinai in New York, and then became an attending at Mount Sinai Beth Israel in New York and worked there up until almost more than 20 years. And then this spring transferred to the Nuvance system in upstate New York. I had been at one point a more general oncologist, but in the 1980s, early 1990s, it became obvious that there was an overwhelming need for specialization within oncology, specifically within breast cancer, with nuanced treatment taking place for hormone positive, HER2 positive, triple negative disease. And what I was intrigued with most with oncology, even back in my more formative years, was the requirement for a multidisciplinary approach and a team effort, which was really pioneered in oncology, working together with surgeons and radiation therapists, immunologists, and laboratory people to get the best results and the best outcome for patients. And that was already very much in vogue in the 1980s, and that was really what pushed me into oncology. And eventually to subspecialize in women's cancer, specifically breast cancer.
And of course, breast cancer is the topic of the San Antonio Breast Cancer Symposium, which is held each year. And this year, it was a hybrid meeting with many people attending the program via their computer to see the streaming media presentations, as well as some people in San Antonio. Let's talk about some of these presentations. The first one we've selected was a prospective screening study reviewing the impact of race and ethnicity on incidence and severity of breast cancer-related lymphedema. Now, lymphedema is a well-known side effect of breast cancer treatment and can really impact the health-related quality of life of patients. Now, this study looks at evidence that suggests that Black women are more likely than white women to experience lymphedema. Tell me, please, why was this an important study?
Well, lymphedema, which is the swelling of the surgical side, the arm of the surgical side, post-radiation, post-surgery, is a serious problem and accounts, generally speaking, about somewhere between 10 and 15% of patients with breast cancer. And there really has never been a good prospective analysis as to who is at risk. Is it the surgery itself? Is it the body habitus of the patient? Is it the subcharacterizations of the cancer? Is it the applications of therapy other than surgery, radiation, and or chemotherapy? And this was a large trial that originally started out with over 800 patients and eventually, because of the requirements of the trial, got honed down to about 300 patients that could be evaluated. And looking to see what are the actual risk factors. There at one time were concerns about traveling in airplanes, whether or not you had exercise. This was the first one to look in a prospective fashion with objective criteria for measuring lymphedema, not just the old-fashioned cloth tape around the arm, but more high-tech kind of evaluation by volumetric analysis. How big is the arm? How big is it compared to the opposite arm? And so forth. Also changes over time. So in that way, it was the first really good large prospective analysis of risk.
Interestingly, most studies of lymphedema do not report about the racial or ethnic background of the study population. But in this case, the investigators did. So one of the reasons they say is that as a result, they could assess if race and ethnicity are a factor in risk of lymphedema. The investigators found that receiving neoadjuvant chemotherapy, older age, and increasing time from surgery are all predictors of lymphedema. However, they also found that being Black is one of the strongest predictors. What contributes to this?
Oh, well, if you're asking for the explanation based solely on race, I cannot give that to you. But there are the other factors involved in women of African-American background. They tended to have bigger women with a higher body mass index. They also tended to have more nodal involvement. Some of that relates sort back to delay in diagnosis sometimes in terms of the aggressivity of the treatment. But if one looks to, they had the highest rate of lymphedema, the African-American women with almost 40% by 2 years in the study, while only 20-odd percent of Caucasian women had lymphedema by that time. There were overlapping risk factors aside from race. There were in terms of whether or not they received preoperative chemotherapy was also a risk factor. And if you weigh into that the larger the disease and the more palpable diseases in the axilla, meaning node positivity and large tumors, those are the patients that are going to get neoadjuvant chemotherapy. Ergo, the African-American women tended to have more lymphedema. But even in the multivariate analysis, when one excludes all the other coexisting factors, Black demographics of African-American women had a very high risk compared to even the Hispanics women, which were next in line, and then Asians and then Caucasian women. Why that is, we don't know the real physiology by demographics as to what's going on in the axilla with the differences between Caucasian women and African-American women. If it relates to the chemotherapy, maybe it's inflammation in the lymph nodes that is more common in the larger African-American women than it is in the thinner Caucasian women. We don't know the answers to those questions. These are provocative and sort of hypothesis-generating kinds of questions that's going to take another level of investigation to figure that out.
And I think that this is definitely an interesting observation. But as you just said, more work is needed to identify ways to improve outcomes for people who are disproportionately affected by cancer, which requires research efforts that range in scope from designing and implementing culturally appropriate health interventions to improving access to care and clinical trials, to examining genetic factors that may explain differences and why there is a difference in the first place, right?
Yeah, you have to tweak out all the individual sub-factors and perhaps gain a greater insight into the actual mechanistic process as to what's going on in the different demographic subsets.
Let's take a short break, and then we're back with Dr. Stephen Malamud.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
How good are vitamin C supplements? Usually only a small proportion of vitamin C actually reaches your cells and has a positive effect. Whereas the high absorption levels of Goldman Laboratories' liposomal vitamin C help maintain optimal vitamin C levels in your body and strengthen your immune system. Now get 10% off when you choose Goldman Laboratories' liposomal vitamin C capsules. Just quote 10 off at goldmanlaboratories.com.
Do you suffer from pain? B-Cure Laser, a home-use CE-approved medical device for the effective treatment of pain, is now available in the UK. The results of a double-blind trial has shown that B-Cure Laser offers a significant reduction in pain compared to the placebo group. To get your special B-Cure offer now, call free on 0808 501 5122 or Google Radio Pro London. B-Cure Laser.
The station that makes you feel good.
This is the Alkazine Brief on UK Health Radio, your real feel-good radio with Peter Hofflin.
And welcome back. In today's episode of the Oncogene Brief, I'm talking with Dr. Stephen Malamud. Dr. Malamud is the Regional Director of Medical Oncology at Nuvens Health, a health network with hospitals, medical practices, and care centers located throughout New York's Hudson Valley and Western Connecticut. I'm Peter Hofland, and this is the Oncogene Brief. Now, another presentation includes updates from the KEYNOTE 522 trial. An article published in February 2020 in the New England Journal of Medicine concluded that among patients with early triple-negative breast cancer, the percentage with a pathological complete response was significantly higher among those who received pembrolizumab plus neoadjuvant chemotherapy than among those who received placebo plus neoadjuvant chemotherapy. The primary analysis of that study showed a statistically significant and clinically meaningful improvement in event-free survival with pembrolizumab plus chemotherapy, followed by pembrolizumab. To assess the robustness and consistency of the primary event-free survival results, the study investigators performed a new subgroup analysis. Now, before we're going to talk about these results, first of all, as a reminder, why is triple-negative breast cancer so difficult to treat? And what is the current standard of care?
Well, triple-negative breast cancer is, as is described, it is negative for the estrogen receptor. It is negative for the progesterone receptor, which means that it's hormone insensitive. Hormone manipulation will not change the outcome of that disease. And it's also HER2-negative, which is the third driving force that we know about or can make significant impact, and ergo triple-negative. It has always been the most difficult of the tumor types to handle effectively. They tend to have rapid recurrences. They tend to occur more commonly in younger women, or more commonly associated with the BRCA1 and BRCA2 genetic defects. after standard cytotoxic chemotherapy, meaning, you know, chemotherapy of the past, there were often relapses shortly thereafter. So the treatment has now evolved to looking to find other means of addressing triple negative breast cancer, finding new targets for our new thrust into targeted therapy. And the KEYNOTE-522 was one of several trials looking at immune modulation to try and strip the triple negative breast cancer of its immune protection such that the body can elicit an immune response and help control that cancer. Immunomodulatory therapy has become a very popular approach in many tumor types in the United States, and breast cancer is just now the latest.
So instead of looking at a target like HER2, in this approach, you're looking to destroy the protective layer protecting the cancer to remove it.
The camouflage that the tumor puts up, more or less. Other targets are being explored. Other antibodies that address other potential targets are being looked at. But so far, immune modulation seems to be taking hold in the treatment of triple negative breast cancer.
And this is a relatively new approach.
Yeah, definitely. In terms of solid tumor, it's a new approach. Definitely in breast cancer, it's a new approach. It had found originally its way into the treatment of metastatic breast cancer, which is usually the case. And now with the KEYNOTE-522, it's looking at the neoadjuvant, meaning treating prior to surgery and then deciding upon what needs to be done postoperatively. And lastly, eventually in the treatment of adjuvant breast cancer, patients perhaps who did not get immune therapy or immunomodulatory therapy prior to their surgery, but become candidates for it postoperatively.
So the KEYNOTE-522 study, with more than 3 years of follow-up, may offer women with high-risk early-stage triple-negative breast cancer a new treatment option for this aggressive disease. Can we say that this is potentially practice-changing?
Yeah, I mean, the 522 data has been available for a while. This is a reaffirmation of that. The FDA also has recognized the value of neoadjuvant immunomodulatory therapy with pembrolizumab in breast cancer. So I think there's general consensus that the right patient in terms of the volume of disease and other comorbid factors are candidates for immunomodulatory therapy preoperatively and potentially postoperatively.
The next study discusses the results of the phase 3 EMERALD study, with the first oral selective estrogen receptor degrader, or SERD, to demonstrate a statistically significant and clinically meaningful improvement of progression-free survival versus standard of care in patients with estrogen receptor-positive, HER2-negative breast cancer in the second and third line setting. Tell me a little bit more about this study and the study results.
Well, in terms of background, there are several ways of treating hormone-positive breast cancer. One, you can block the effect of estrogen on the receptor, and that's been the classic way that tamoxifen for years, now since the 1980s, has been treating breast cancer, both pre- and postmenopausal. There's also the mechanism of reducing the amount of estrogen in the system, and that would be through the aromatase inhibitors. There are also now three of them available in the United States. There is also a treatment plan using something, a drug called fulvestrant, which is an estrogen receptor downregulator or degrader. And what this actually does is actually will destroy the estrogen receptor so it no longer is there to react to circulating estrogens, whether or not they've been reduced or blocked. The only available estrogen receptor downregulator, or SERD, in this country is a parenteral, meaning injectable agent that one has to give once a month as a injections into each buttock, which I'm sure you can imagine is not particularly friendly. It requires a visit every month for treatment and is an uncomfortable procedure. Elacestrant is the first oral SERD of this category to come to this stage of development, where it will almost certainly in a short period of time be presented for potential acceptance in this country as an oral SERD. It offers the advantage of oral therapy rather than parenteral injectable therapy, and the data suggests in the trial that was conducted, the Emerald trial, that it is as effective without any loss of potency to the parent of the original mother drug, the fulvestrin, even in the patients who had seen plenty of hormone therapy in the past. Of course, again, I'll be a little bit more concerned in the sense of the cost of that agent. In the United States, parenteral agents are covered by insurance. Oral agents are sometimes left a bit open-ended there in terms of insurance coverage for oral medications. But it is an advantage over parenterals in the comfort level.
So definitely an improvement in the way this drug is administered. But one thing that comes to mind, and I think that has been a concern for a lot of oncologists in the past when it comes to oral medications, is the question about adherence. Some patients may simply not adhere to an oral treatment regimen. Is that a real concern?
Well, yes, certainly it does. It would be, you can certainly be certain if you give an injection, it's in, you've done it, you know they've gotten it. You have to choose the patient in terms of their history of compliance. This medication comes with relatively few side effects that would drive a non-compliance. Cost would, of course, be a non-compliance if it's an out-of-pocket cost for the drug, in which case one would immediately switch back to the parenteral agent. But the side effects are not really any different than the injectable medication. A little bit of nausea, and that's really about it. And I think the main issue is going to be availability of the medication, the cost of the medication. I'm not certain that toxicity or side effects are going to drive noncompliance for this agent.
And I guess to help patients adhere, it also requires a little bit more in terms of patient education from the care team.
Well, certainly if there are issues that the patient brings up in between visits, they will have to be addressed by phone to try and coax them through it. Perhaps more anti-nausea medication might be required. Again, anytime you have oral agents, but I think in general in oncology, at least in my practice, there is always a really strong bond and a tight communications between the patients, the nursing staff, and myself.
When we look at this treatment option, does this improve the health-related quality of life of patients?
There are still plenty of patients out there that are somewhat needle-phobic. That might be an explanation for some of the COVID vaccination data or lack thereof, but also the pain at the injection site. Sometimes there are patients, especially older women, who don't have a lot of body mass, especially around their buttocks. So it becomes more problematic to give an deep muscular injection into the buttock if someone has already lost a lot of weight or is thin from the get-go. The fact they would not necessarily need to come into the office every month to get two shots, one into each cheek, is a quality of life issue, especially in more rural environments where it may be more difficult for patients to come in monthly. Even when I was practicing in Manhattan, it was a challenge for patients to come in from the boroughs and then park in a garage that cost them another $50 to park. So there are a lot of fewer office visits, the lack of injection pain, I think all contribute to quality of life issues.
Would you consider this a potentially practice-changing treatment?
Yeah, potentially, depending on, again, the availability of the drug.
Let's take a break. If you're just joining us, in this episode of The Oncogene Brief, I'm talking with Dr. Stephen Malamud. Dr. Malamud is the Regional Director of Medical Oncology at Nuvens Health, a health network with hospitals, medical practices, and care centers located throughout New York's Hudson Valley and Western Connecticut. In this episode of The Oncogene Brief, we talk about some of the results of studies presented during the San Antonio Breast Cancer Symposium, held December 7 to 10, 2021, in San Antonio, Texas, and virtually via streaming media. I'm Peter Hoffland, and this is The Oncogene Brief.
Sarcoma. Odds are you've never heard that word before. For the 40 people diagnosed with sarcoma every day, it is a life-changing word because sarcoma is cancer. Through awareness, advocacy, and research, the Sarcoma Foundation of America is bringing hope to the families whose lives have been turned upside down by a cancer they had never heard of until diagnosis. Please join us in the fight to find the cure for sarcoma. For more information on the work of the Sarcoma Foundation of America, go to curesarcoma.org.
This is the Oncozine Brief on UK Health Radio, your real feel-good radio with Peter Hofland.
And welcome back. In today's episode of the Oncozine Brief, I'm talking with Dr. Stephen Malamud. I'm Peter Hofland, and this is the Oncozine Brief. Let's look at another study, results from the RESPONDER study, which was designed to determine the effect of chemotherapy, shows that the majority of women who are over 50 years of age will not necessarily benefit from chemotherapy, while women who are under 50 years of age may continue to show a benefit. This is an update from an older study. Tell me, please, a little bit more about the study and why you think the results are important.
So this was the RESPONDER trial that was presented by Kevin Kalinske, and it was a second go with Oncotype DX, which is the genomic analysis, looking at node-positive breast cancer, up to 3 positive nodes. This was originally published back in the New England Journal not long ago. And the bottom line is that in those patients that had 1 to 3 positive nodes, but a Oncotype score 26 or less, if they were over 50, they were not benefiting from chemotherapy. And that meant that more than 50% of those women did not need chemotherapy. What was distinct from that trial is the potential and the persistent value in chemotherapy for women under the age of 50 or premenopausal who had 1 to 3 positive nodes. There was a benefit for those patients who were node positive, almost regardless of what their Oncotype score was. So right now, Oncotype would be, I think, become standard of care for women 1 to 3 positive nodes over the age of 50 to try and differentiate those who will and will not benefit from the addition of chemotherapy. Women who are premenopausal and under the age of 50 almost always seem to have benefited somewhat from chemotherapy to various degrees, where now the role of the Oncotype DX in the premenopausal women is mainly to help in prognostication rather than in the decision-making as to whether or not they need chemotherapy or not.
When you look at your own practice, for example, how might these results change the way you treat patients?
We had already been doing pretty much what we had participated at, actually, in our responder. So we were already quite familiar with where we were going there. I think for the most part, all women over the age of 50 in this office will be getting Oncotype studies, genomic analysis, if they have 1 to 3 positive nodes and smaller tumors. Women under the age of 50, again, they will almost certainly be getting chemotherapy, but some of them still, and I oftentimes will want to see what their actual prognostication is. What is the prognosis predicted by the genomic analysis, and perhaps use that as a means to decide upon what kind of chemotherapy, how aggressive might that chemotherapy need to be. But the genomic analysis, I think we've gone far and away what used to be the TNM classification. How big is it? Are there lymph nodes? Are there metastases? We're getting much more nuanced and into the subtleties of the biology of that tumor, and not relying so much on numbers of nodes and how big is the tumor, but the true biology. And that's going to come even more so when we start really cutting up the genetic profile of these tumors beyond the 16 genes looked at with genomic Oncotype DX.
These study results show that genomics play a role in guiding treatment decisions. And as you've just explained, for patients with early stage ER-positive, HER2-negative, node-negative, and node-positive breast cancer, the Oncotype DX breast recurrence score quantifies the risk of distant recurrences and the likelihood of chemotherapy benefit. Knowing the breast recurrence score may guide a care team to the right systemic adjuvant treatment decision. Now, in case a patient does not benefit from added chemotherapy, how do you treat?
Well, these patients are all hormone positive, so they will all get hormone anti-estrogen therapy. The question that's being asked in this particular trial, what is the advantage of adding chemotherapy to that foundation of anti-estrogen therapy? And if they don't need the hormone chemotherapy, that avoids a lot of the toxicities and issues related to quality of life. The other topic that was discussed quite a lot was the role of ovarian suppression and whether or not turning off a young woman's ovaries in combination with an anti-estrogen approach is equivalent to or better than chemotherapy if you've elected not to use chemotherapy. That is still a very hotly debated topic, and there was a debate actually devoted to that topic of ovarian suppression, yes or no, in the setting of early stage breast cancer.
What was the conclusion of the majority?
I think if you took a vote, it was split right down the middle. I think the higher the risk, the closer you are to chemotherapy, the more likely it is you're going to get offered ovarian suppression.
Are these results practice changing?
Perhaps in some quarters, others had already been adopting this technique. But as per NCCN guidelines, the current recommendation is in this setting of women with 1 to 3 positive nodes, small tumor, hormone positive, the genomic analysis is critical in deciding upon chemotherapy, yes or no, especially in the women over the age of 50 and postmenopausal.
And the presented results were an update from a previous study, right?
Yeah. A new analysis was built into that in terms of the interval-free time, which was not reported in the New England Journal.
Let's look at the results from a subgroup analysis from the randomized phase 3 DESTINY Breast 3 trial, which included trastuzumab deruxtecan versus trastuzumab emtansine in patients with HER2-positive metastatic breast cancer. Both drugs are so-called antibody-drug conjugates, or ADCs. Tell me a little bit more about this class of agents.
Okay, well, the ADCs, or antibody-drug conjugates, are, I guess you would have to liken it to what's been called a smart bomb in medical oncology. What you're doing is you're picking your target, in this case HER2, and using the antibody that's been available since the onset, trastuzumab, and attaching to that monoclonal antibody a chemotherapy drug moiety, sometimes only measured in a couple of molecules on top of this antibody. And the logic behind it is that the antibody brings the chemotherapy drug to its target on the surface of the tumor cell, very specifically targeting these couple of molecules to the tumor cell. They attach to the tumor cell and then by cell processes internalize it and kill the tumor cell. That is the mechanism for all of the ADCs and is the mechanism for trastuzumab deruxtecan in the DESTINY-03 trial.
In this case, we're talking about two approved drugs. Trastuzumab emtansine was among the earlier ADCs approved, and this study compares both agents. What is the difference between trastuzumab deruxtecan and trastuzumab emtansine?
The approach is the same. It still uses the trastuzumab as a targeting agent. The chemotherapy drug is different. T-DM1 uses a drug, maytansine, and the T-DXd or the DESTINY drug, the DESTINY-03 drug uses, again, a different chemotherapy agent. It's possible that the configuration of the molecule is making it more active. It's possible that the chemotherapy drug itself is more active. If you look at the two different drugs, there actually is more chemo medication, chemo drug attached to this new drug than there was to the T-DM1. So maybe it's a number of molecules of chemotherapy attached to the antibody. But the trial that we're talking about actually took T-DM1, the drug that had been available for a while, and compared it to the new drug, the trastuzumab deruxtecan, in metastatic HER2-positive breast cancer in patients who had already seen a fair amount of anti-HER2 therapy.
And what was the outcome of this study?
Well, relatively clear-cut evidence that the newer drug, the trastuzumab deruxtecan, the TXD, was superior to the T-DM1 in first relapse for patients who had previously been treated with anti-HER2 therapy. Really, there's the number of zeros after the P, the number after the decimal point, I think I was more than 20 zeros. So a clearly improved objective response rate, time to progression. What was new in the update reported last week is that the question had been as to what would be the effect on brain metastasis, which are a particular problem in HER2-positive breast cancer, which has a propensity for brain metastasis. Although that was not the specific intent of the trial, they were able to go back and retrospectively look at the breast cancer responses in the brain. And it was, again, dramatically improved over what they saw, what the investigators saw with the pre-existing T-DM1.
Now, tell me a little bit more about reducing brain metastasis. Of course, that's important.
Absolutely. I mean, there are, in HER2-positive breast cancer, we learned pretty quickly that although the body could be well controlled with trastuzumab and chemotherapy, single early relapses in the brain were common, as well as later metastasis when the other areas of the body were also being affected. So HER2 metastatic brain disease is a high level of interest. Another previously existing drug, tucatinib, has already demonstrated value in combination with other medications. It's more of a triplet therapy with trastuzumab, capecitabine, and tucatinib. And that had been our go-to combo for HER2-positive breast cancer metastatic to the brain. This trial was not specifically addressing the metastatic disease to the brain. So likely, we will see a further investigation comparing what has been more or less the standard go-to approach with tucatinib, comparing it to TXD.
If we compare these results with the current standard of care, are they practice-changing?
I would think that with this data presented as it is, outside of the brain, which was not one of the pre-described endpoints in the trial, the new drug, the TXD, will likely replace T-DM1 as the first line for metastatic recurrent HER2-positive breast cancer.
And this will no doubt contribute to an improvement in the health-related quality of life of patients, correct?
Yeah, well, clearly, the quicker you get control of the disease, quality of life goes up. The frequency of administration is about the same. There are differences in terms of the side effect profile, but again, totally manageable from the oncology standpoint.
Let's take a short break, and then we're back with Dr. Stephen Malamud. I'm Peter Hoffland, and this is The Oncogene Brief.
The station that makes you feel good.
Galar Light is the quantum energy emitted from the universe, from the sun and stars. Now, Tom Palladino, a humanitarian and Scalar Light researcher, has created the world's only Scalar Light healing system, a system that can bring long-distance healing and wellness to humans, pets, and plants via a photograph. Get your free 15-day trial now at scalarlight.com or click on the Scalar Light banner on the UK Health Radio website.
Shields like masks are top of mind right now, but did you know you have inner armor working constantly to protect you from pathogens? It keeps you healthy and thriving. It's your immune system. Ion Gut triggers the body's natural ability to support gut strength all year long, so your immune system can protect you when you need it the most. How are you treating your inner armor? Visit uk.ionbiome.com to learn more. Ion Gut. Protect what protects you.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
This is the Oncogene Brief on UK Health Radio, your real feel-good radio with Peter Hoffland.
And welcome back. This is the Oncogene Brief. If you're just joining us, in today's episode of the Oncogene Brief, I'm talking with Dr. Stephen Malamud. Dr. Malamud is the Regional Director of Medical Oncology at Nuvens Health, a health network with hospitals, medical practices, and care centers located throughout New York's Hudson Valley and Western Connecticut. Dr. Malamud is a board-certified and fellowship-trained physician who specializes in medical oncology for breast cancer. And as an active clinical researcher, Dr. Malamud has been involved in clinical trials that resulted in the approval of new cancer treatments. In this episode of the Oncogene Brief, we talk about some of the results of studies presented during the San Antonio Breast Cancer Symposium held December 7 to 10, 2021 in San Antonio, Texas, and virtually via streaming media. Now, let's switch gears a little bit. I was surprised to see a large number of presentations, I think 34 different ones, addressing the link between obesity and breast cancer. That's quite...
frightening, huh?
Yes, frightening indeed. Now, there is a lot of continued interest in studying the link between obesity, inflammation, and the risk of cancer. Tell me a little bit more about the work that was presented during the San Antonio meeting.
Clearly, over the last 5 to 10 years, there's been increasing interest in developing an understanding as to how obesity contributes to breast cancer. It's not all higher estrogen content in larger women. It's not strictly that. There may be an inflammatory component to obesity. Inflammation and breast cancer has been demonstrated to be a potential link there. The fat cells in the breast tend to elicit an inflammatory response. So how also in heavier women, there tends to be a higher endogenous insulin levels, and insulin can be a breast cancer stimulant. So there are many factors. In fact, one of the potential risk factors that was explored and intriguing was the fact of the factor for obesity and even the development and risk and prognosis of genetically driven breast cancer, where we saw that some of the BRCA1 and BRCA2 patients had a higher inflammatory response if they were obese rather than their thinner counterparts. And this is counterproductive to success of treatment and prognosis in breast cancer. Unfortunately, despite even with that enthusiasm, lots of trials were presented, several looking at behavior modification techniques, diet control, fitness controls, trials that were adapting Fitbits to try and get people to a standard exercise program. Unfortunately, there was not a lot of success in achieving weight loss. There was and there's certainly no contribution to improvement in outcome. Patients generally felt better, but could not be actually shown to have an influence on their breast cancer. One of the trials that also I had participated on in the past was looking at an anti-diabetic drug called metformin, which interferes with the metabolic pathway of excess glucose. And although in the laboratory, this looked very exciting in terms of helping in terms of the adjuvant treatment of breast cancer, patients who had breast cancer were ready to try and help in the adjuvant setting, we couldn't prove it. So it's not that we're actually back to the drawing board, but different avenues, different approaches, and different techniques for understanding the mechanism are clearly indicated.
Now, in this country, there is an epidemic of obesity. From where you are, do you see in your practice an increase confirming the link between obesity and breast cancer?
Well, the numbers of women who are in the clinic who are outside of what we'd consider a acceptable BMI, BMI is over 25, 26, 27. I mean, I won't say routinely, but it is all too frequent that we'll see women appearing with BMIs in the 30s or higher. These are patients who we encourage all of our patients to take lifestyle into account. And that does not just mean avoiding smoking and going for colonoscopies, but in terms of daily dietary habits, daily exercise, even if it means just an hour or two of walking a week to keep active, not only for bone health, but for just physical tone, help with their cholesterol and their BMI, dietary observation. So we encourage that as part of standard well-person care.
But this is not something you do after you're diagnosed with breast cancer. This is part of a lifestyle change, just like stopping with smoking.
Absolutely. Just for good general health. I mean, their cardiologist is telling them the same thing. Their internist is telling them the same thing. Hopefully their if they have a pediatrician and younger children, they're telling them the same thing, to avoid excess sweets. Obesity does not start in your 20s. It starts earlier than that with poor dietary habits and lack of exercise. So it's something in this country that needs to be addressed early and not forgotten as men and women get older in life, perhaps even more important.
Well, hopefully, this will reduce the number of patients being diagnosed with breast cancer. But what is your advice for patients when you see them in the clinic?
Well, everyone in the clinic automatically will get a nutrition consult. Everybody gets a consult with nutrition to evaluate what their diet is currently. Usually what ends up being recommended is a reduction in carbohydrate intake, assuring that they get enough vegetables into their diet and bulk, avoiding fatty meats, avoiding excess calories from fat. But it's mainly reduction of carbohydrates and increasing activity and a balanced diet. I mean, I've always felt that a healthy, balanced diet is better than a plate full of pills.
And with all the results presented during this symposium, there is definitely some practice-changing information that may help increase the health-related quality of life of patients that were diagnosed with breast cancer.
Absolutely. Things that we do later after the diagnosis is established, but potentially even more important, what the patient can do before they become patients in their early lives to address these issues where certain things do impact on their outcome. And that's smoking, blood pressure control, and in the case of breast cancer, obesity and activity.
We're almost at the end of the program, and we only had time to discuss a handful of presentations. But are there any other presentations that stand out?
Well, I think patients and oncologists know this information. At least I hope so. I think patients should take heart that the progress in breast cancer continues. The progress in hormone-positive breast cancer is continuing with the development of new drugs that work along with the estrogen-specific agent. Agents that target cofactors that work together with the estrogen. We're now past the two-year mark easily for survivorship with metastatic or hormone-positive breast cancer. Drugs that we were waiting on data that proved overall survival are now passing two-year marks for overall survival. Drugs like ribociclib in young premenopausal women and in postmenopausal women. So again, a recent 4-6 inhibitor, abemaciclib, now approved in the setting of adjuvant therapy of breast cancer, also practice changing. So again, patients with a diagnosis of breast cancer should not be disheartened, but should take heart and take faith that there is continued progress on the horizon.
Dr. Stephen Malamuth, thank you so much for joining us today.
My deepest pleasure. Stay well.
In this episode of The Oncogene Brief, I spoke with Dr. Stephen Malamuth. Dr. Malamuth is the Regional Director of Medical Oncology at Nuvance Health, a health network with hospitals, medical practices, and care centers located throughout New York's Hudson Valley and Western Connecticut. We spoke about some of the results of studies presented during the San Antonio Breast Cancer Symposium held December 7 to 10, 2021 in San Antonio, Texas, and virtually via streaming media. For more information about Nuvance Health, go to www.nuvancehealth.org. For us here at The Oncogene Brief, we want to thank you, our listeners, sponsors, and advertisers, for your ongoing support. Your support makes it possible that you can hear this program via PRX Public Radio Exchange and in the United Kingdom and mainland Europe via UK Health Radio. And you can also download our program via podcast and streaming media, including iTunes and Spotify. For more information about supporting The Oncogene Brief, go to oncozine@oncozine.com. That is oncozine.com. If you're living in the United States and want to receive our newsletter, text the word cancer, C-A-N-C-E-R, to 66866. And we will make sure that you'll receive our newsletter, which includes an overview of the latest news in oncology and hematology. Thank you all. And thank you for listening, and join us again for our next episode. I'm Peter Hofland, and this is the Oncogene Brief.
The Oncogene Brief is a global medical educational service from the publishers of Oncogene and ADC Review, the Journal of Antibody Drug Conjugates. Support for the Oncogene Brief comes from our commercial underwriters and advertisers and the listeners to this station. For more information about advertising, underwriting, and sponsoring options, visit Oncogene at www.oncogene.com/podcasts. The Oncogene Brief contains health and medicine-related information and is provided for educational and entertainment purposes only. The content in this program is not intended as a substitute for professional medical or health advice and does not replace your doctor's advice and guidance. Your doctor is the best person to answer questions about your personal health. If you hear something in this program that doesn't agree with what your doctor has told you, ask him or her about it.